For KOSU News, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Governor Stitt signs bills to give him more power over five agencies. The governor now has power to hire and fire the leaders of the Departments of Transportation, Corrections, Mental Health, as well as the Oklahoma Health Care Authority and Office of Juvenile Affairs. The boards and commissions of the five agencies are getting reconstituted under the new legislation. Neva, again, we're talking about legislation which flew through the legislature and were quickly signed by the governor.
Absolutely. And this is something that the governor wanted, as we've talked about, something that the legislative leaders came together, hammered out their differences, came to a deal. And as Speaker McCall said during the signing ceremony, that the pace was nothing short of miraculous, the term he used. And you're right, Michael. I mean, this is something that was on a fast track, something the governor wanted. And I think when you look at it, it came down in both chambers on party line votes. It was clearly a Republican initiative. I think it does speak to the governor's negotiating skills and his ability to really forge a consensus among his strong majority in both the House and the Senate and move these things forward quickly. So it does reconstitute the boards, which happens, I think, effective today. So we're going to see some sweeping changes very quickly, and I think it moves right in line with what the governor has talked about from day one when he took office.
Ryan.
I think you break it down into a couple of different, you can break it down into politics and policy. The politics here are just incredible. You know, what we're really seeing is a governor who has seized the power of the executive, who's made himself a force to be reckoned with in that building, which is, again, not something that we've seen for the last 8 years at least, a governor that has been this engaged in the legislative process. And these bills, and correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but I think that these are the first bills that have hit his desk that have an emergency clause, so they go into effect. So even though these are not the first bills that he has signed, these are the first laws under the Stitt administration that will become law, that are law right now. And so, you know, I think that that's a big thing to consider there, and a big hallmark for his administration. The politics of this, we're already beginning to see, you know, some of the members of the board, some of the agency heads, you know, beginning to play this new political game of trying to ingratiate themselves to the governor and saying, you know, we welcome this, we look forward to, because they're reapplying for their jobs today. I mean, that's every, you know, when you look at those five agency directors, they're going to the governor's office and they're saying, rehire me. And so that's, we're starting to see some of the politics of that in the media play out. You know, there have been some comments, and I do think that the consolidation of the power in the executive could be problematic here. But we've seen some comments recently from people that have been on these boards in the past that say that, you know, governors, if they've wanted to exercise the power, they've had this power all along. And so it's just really a recalibrating of where that power is going to be directed.
And you know, I think it's interesting, too, when we talk about these changes, they really come behind in 2012 when the voters decided and went to the polls and said that we needed to change how business was done at the Department of Human Services. Mm-hmm. DHS, I mean, after all of the scandals, basically what happened was exactly what is happening with these agencies, the ability for the governor to hire the executive director and for kind of reconstituting the way they operate at DHS. And then last year, I mean, the legislature didn't wait for action to be taken when we had the total scandal and debacle at the health department, where they took the initiative to have these same measures put in place. So I think what we're seeing is the landscape changing in state government, where there's going to be much more accountability and much more transparency with these changes that have come about.
And certainly more issues if something goes wrong, that it goes up to the governor when it comes up for re-election.
Yeah, the buck stops with him. I think that it'll be interesting to see if there is more transparency, if there is more accountability. One of the things that when we look at this is, you know, maybe by empowering these boards more, we'd have more accountability and transparency, not by, because essentially they're advisory at this point. I mean, their ability to hire and fire is gone. They serve at will. They can't be removed. They can be removed even if they don't have cause to remove them. So if they disagree with the governor, if they disagree with the mission of the administration, or maybe even the legislature at some point, given the provisions in these bills, they could be gone. So those could be political, not policy
decisions. I don't see that's as big an issue, because I think what you have with these boards and commissions, even the way they were before these changes coming into play, you had folks that were lay people coming, serving on boards and commissions. basically having to take in large measure what the paid executive director, the head folks and in these agencies were telling them. And so they basically were in most cases just affirming what was already going on in these agencies. You didn't find much antagonism or much consternation in these board meetings where people were raising issues. Those issues may have been raised privately or, you know, one-on-one, but I think we'll have actually a much more vibrant process where we'll see probably a more exchange of ideas in this context than we have ever before.
And that's where I'm saying, I think that, you know, we could have gone down a different path where instead of consolidating power in the governor's office here, we could have given these boards and commissions even more power so that they were less advisory, so that they were less, you know, volunteer-based, but that we had fully staffed, fully employed boards that were operating as a real check on these agency directors. But of course, that's not the path we've gone, and we'll see what happens.
A measure known as the Unity Bill is heading to the governor's desk for his signature after passing the State House and Senate. The measure adds regulation on the medical marijuana state question passed by voters last year. Ryan, House Bill 2612 appears to have approval from most medical marijuana supporters.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this puts the medical cannabis program in the state of Oklahoma on a path toward success. I mean, if we've seen huge numbers in patient applications. We've seen huge numbers in processors, dispensaries, manufacturers, growers, you know, people that are involved. This has become a much bigger industry than I think even the people within the industry expected. And it's happened very fast. I think by and large, most of the folks out there are above the board operators doing the best that they can, but this gives some people some framework. You know, these laws don't go into effect until 90 days after the adjournment of the legislative session. So everybody's going to have some time to get up to speed with the new regulations and requirements. But it's going to, at the end of the day, I think, despite some small problems with the bill, I think at the end of the day, what we're going to see is an industry that's safer for consumers and patients, so that they've got access. They have a better idea of what it is that they're getting. They can know that it's being tested, that it's that it meets the requirements of the states around us, and that it's not just, you know, the total Wild West in medical cannabis in Oklahoma.
Yeah, Neva.
Well, I think the bill was very comprehensive. It dealt with so many issues that, frankly, the public doesn't really even consider are part of what had to be hammered out. I mean, what are safety sensitive jobs? How is the lab testing going to be done to make sure that we have a product out there that is not going to adversely affect the folks that are buying it, the licensing procedure, the packaging procedure, all of these things. And now we're seeing probably a dozen or more trailer bills, you know, out there still working through the process that are still dealing with some additional things. I mean, the disposal issue. I mean, all of these things that I think not only will we see move through the legislative process this year, but I think they'll come back in years to come and have additional issues that will come up, just like we've seen with tobacco and other issues that they will have to continue to deal with legislatively.
I think Ada Republican Senator Greg McCourtney has a dozen bills. Still, just the Unity Bill didn't tackle, but again, none of those seem to be having any problems. They're pretty bipartisan as well.
Well, and I think that, you know, Neva pointed out the safety-sensitive jobs. You know, those are people that aren't precluded from getting a patient license, but they don't have the same kind of employment protections because of their safety-sensitive jobs. I think that section of the bill is probably overbroad. I think that it captures too many individuals, and it's important to remember here that this is, at this point in Oklahoma, we're talking about medical cannabis, medical marijuana. These are patients. They're using this as medicine, and to have huge sections of industries that are precluded from having any sort of employment protection to have access to a medicine that's recommended to them by a physician, I think, you know, that part is probably going to get retooled at some point as we get a better sense of what this looks like. And I think as stigma breaks down, right? I mean, 6 months ago, I think more and more Oklahomans would have had a harder time knowing somebody that regularly used marijuana products. And now we're at a point where you're hard pressed to find somebody that doesn't have a patient. I've got a patient license. And I think that as that stigma breaks down and more people know somebody who uses marijuana as a medicine or uses marijuana as medicine themselves, legislators will get more educated about that. I'd be interested to know if there are any legislators that have patient cards.
Yeah, I was outside my shop, my gaming shop, and the guy was vaping a medical marijuana. I'm like, oh, you didn't think? I was like, okay, only in Oklahoma now, apparently.
Did he have his open carry with him? Yeah, was that the well, that hasn't gone into effect yet?
But clearly there had to be areas where there were concerns.
Right.
I mean, if you have someone handling hazardous or combustible materials, if you have police and firefighters, if you have folks that are operating, heavy machinery. I mean, any number of things that are specifically outlined as the jobs in this bill. Clearly, there were many more that probably were on the table that didn't make it. But I think it was a give and take, and I think what they came up with, even in terms of people that are involved in patient care or in child care. I mean, you're right. It's a long list when you really read through it. But these are places where I think the public would generally be in agreement that that it would warrant this kind of action.
And there are reasonable restrictions that exist on opioid use. I mean, if you're on heavy pain medication, you shouldn't be operating heavy machinery or driving. Mm-hmm. That could preclude you from certain occupations there. And so, I mean, I think that reasonable limitations there. I think that those carve outs need to be narrower, and I think that they really need to the extent possible, be focused on the use of medical cannabis while you're performing that function. And so if you use medical cannabis the night before to help yourself go to sleep, get a better night's sleep, or to deal with, you know, some sort of anxiety issue that keeps you from sleeping, and then you wake up the next morning, you're not still under the influence of medical cannabis. You should be able to go do your job. It should be incumbent upon the employer then to say, this person is under the influence of work.
Do you think that this might actually, because when it talks about narrowing the law, that usually goes in the court system. Do you think some of these might actually end up going to court?
I think it'd be difficult to win a court case here. I don't think it's impossible, but I think it would be difficult to go to court and get a court to overturn these narrow limits. And again, as much as I think that that's something that's going to be revisited, this is certainly just light years away from where we were with the health department's initial rule promulgation after 788. And so lawmakers learned a lesson there. They saw the political backlash that happened after the health department promulgated those rules that were very heavy-handed, very restrictive, and would have destroyed the industry and patient access. And so this unity bill is really a bipartisan response to that political outcry that happened after this, not only after 788 passed, but after the health department's rules.
And I think these lawmakers have been wise to look at states like Colorado, California, right, Oregon. I mean, places that have already gone down this road and not make the same mistakes that they did. So I think they've been very prudent, and some of these folks that have really spent months now really getting into the weeds of trying to understand what's going on and try to make the best decisions possible in Oklahoma, I think is what got it to the place where now it's on the governor's desk waiting to be signed.
Yeah.
Governor Stitt wants the state auditor to investigate the Oklahoma Health Care Authority to determine whether the agency is meeting the needs of the state's Medicaid beneficiaries. Stitt also wants to determine if those enrolled meet state and federal eligibility requirements. Neva, why is this necessary?
Well, to me, this is just putting teeth and an executive order behind something that was passed last year by the legislature. Representative Terry O'Donnell, his bill basically asked or called for the health care authority to have this audit, and it would appear, at least from the outside, that this was bureaucracy somewhat stonewalling the legislature because nothing had happened. And so I think what the governor is saying is, look, we need this information. I mean, this is a billion-dollar operation, I mean, with a change at the helm in the offing, and I think that it's important to figure out exactly the eligibility, the re-eligibility. This information is critical to be able to move forward and make the decisions necessary to do whatever they choose in restructuring or changing direction in the agency. It certainly has an impact down the road, and I think as we've talked about, the Medicaid discussion may well have not gone away. It may be part of this process as we get into the real throes of negotiating on the budget, that we may see some give and take. The governor's not firmly set down his position, concretely on this matter, and I think this is just another piece in the equation to see where it goes.
Ryan.
I mean, I think that this could be the pretext for a couple of different things. And he talked about, Governor Stitt talked about this during his campaign. This is a campaign promise of his. He's making good on with the call for the audit. The healthcare authority, they're saying that they welcome the audit, which of course they said that they welcome the audit. What else are you going to say? We don't know about this, guys.
They didn't welcome it when the legislature
look
asked
over here,
the
shiny object, shiny object. No, I think that, you know, of course, you know, the they have to welcome it. If it's like I said, it could be the pretext for a couple of different things. One of them would be really concerning, and that is looking at the roles of folks on Medicaid and in an effort to purge them, to, you know, to try to save some money on the backs of the most vulnerable populations in the state of Oklahoma by kicking them off Medicaid. But the other thing, the other pretext, and this is one where I'm a little bit more hopeful, is that this gives the governor a baseline. This gives the governor some information about Medicaid, the healthcare authority, you know, where they actually stand, what the numbers look like. And that could be the basis for a real, a meaningful talk within the governor's office about expanding Medicaid. And so if we're going to have Medicaid expansion in the state of Oklahoma, I think for this governor to be satisfied and walk into that conversation with good faith, he's got to have this information. And so hopefully after this is done, that will lead that'll pave the way for a real conversation about Medicaid expansion in Oklahoma.
And hopefully, I mean, the state auditor, Cindy Byrd, I mean, certainly her office is tasked with this responsibility to get the audit done, and hopefully it can be done fairly quickly, because I think this information is really something that is needed to kind of move forward with what needs to happen at the healthcare authority this session and this year.
I mean, the Tulsa World reported in their story about this, they reported a comment that Governor Stitt made on the campaign trail. He said the problem with expanding Medicaid is that it puts more people in our system. Well, of course it does. That's exactly, we're trying to cover more people with healthcare. So I don't see that as a problem.
And I don't know that he necessarily sees it as a problem. I think what they want to see is that the enrollment is meeting the state and federal eligibility requirements. And I think once that's determined, I mean, those numbers are what everyone will move forward and work with. But at this point, no one has good numbers, and that's what's missing.
Yeah, I'm choosing to be hopeful about this.
More than 150 former and current employees of the State Department of Health are suing the agency. The petition alleges they were fired, forced to resign, or forced to retire in 2017 and 2018 after the department claimed the termination of about 200 employees was necessary due to a $30 million deficiency. It was later discovered the department wasn't ever, in fact, insolvent. Ryan, do we have a case here?
I think it's a really tough case to make. You know, Oklahoma is an at-will state. I read through the petition this morning to get a better sense of the claims that are being made. I think that the politics of it, you know, I think 9 out of 10 Oklahomans would tell you that these employees were wronged and that they got the raw deal here, that they were the victims of malfeasance, of negligence. But whether or not that rises to the level of civil liability on behalf of the state of Oklahoma and the health department, I think that's going to be a really difficult case to make. The idea that you have a legal right to work for an employer that manages their finances appropriately, you know, there are a lot of people out there that work for companies that, you know, nosedive into the ground because of poor management, and your ability to go sue the management because you lost your job. Because, you know, I think that's kind of the case here. The difference is that this is a state employee or a state employer. Mm-hmm. And so, there could be some statutory rights there. There's also the question of this being a political question. I mean, the way that those 9 out of 10 people that are upset about these employees losing their jobs, I'm upset about them losing their jobs, but the way that we deal with that is through political accountability, and you hold the people responsible that make those political decisions that led to this mismanagement in the first place.
Neva.
Well, I mean, the legal aspect aside, I mean, when you think back to the multi-county grand jury report last May, I mean, it basically said two things: that A, the agency was never insolvent, and B, that the elimination of the jobs was unnecessary. So, I mean, you have a situation where, do they go down the road of basically saying someone should get their job back with back pay, or do they get a wrongful termination, you know, with a settlement? I mean, I think you're right. I think it will be an interesting court case to watch unfold. But you're right. I mean, the public perception on this, the fact that it doesn't it doesn't pass any test. I mean, and as people remember, this was done right before a Christmas holiday season. I mean, the impact on, you know, the state and the black eye that that we all incurred having to watch this it was scandalous. I mean, to see an agency that out of control and run amok and then to have these consequences, you know, there's not an easy way to write the total situation, but it's certainly something we need to remember and hopefully not see happen again.
And if the courts come back and say that just because the firings were unnecessary, that doesn't necessarily violate Oklahoma's at-will
statute.
Right. I mean,
that's
that
right.
could happen.
That's right.
But the legislature could fix that. So, I mean, if we get to that point where this case is dismissed or ultimately, you know, for whatever reason, you know, a jury finds against the state employees here, the former state employees here, whatever that looks like, the legislature could come in and they could give state employees greater rights and greater employment protections so that whenever this does happen in the future, there isn't any guesswork as to whether or not, you know, is there a case here or not, that, you know, they could codify some due process requirements, some notice requirements, some opportunity to be rehired. I mean, there are some legal hurdles that stood in the way of people being rehired to their old jobs. You know, so you had somebody that was fired, you had a vacant position that needed to be filled, oftentimes in rural areas where you had services that were gone, and because of a law that said this person can't be rehired for a job that they were terminated from, you took the most qualified applicant and you disqualified them. So those are things that, you know, regardless of this litigation, this is something that the legislature could pick up.
A report in the Tulsa World shows a teacher pay raise in Texas might be good news for Oklahoma educators. Texas is considering a $5,000 raise, while Oklahoma is just considering $1,200. Governor Stitt's office says it's monitoring the Texas legislature and still wants Oklahoma to be number one in this endeavor. Neva, how do you interpret this?
Well, I think I'm not sure how to fully interpret it, but in looking at it and trying to read a little bit more about what's going on down there, it may, in the minds of some, even in the Texas Teachers Association, they see this as a pay raid, not a pay raise. I mean, that's being talked about, because it's kind of the bait and switch. I mean, yes, they're talking about giving them a raise, but they're talking about reducing their benefits or the cost would be greatly increased for their, you know, for their benefits. So, and it doesn't, what appears to be, you know, one number that looks really good, when you start looking at the real effect of it, it may be something totally different. And, you know, I'm always a little suspect when we look at these things. I mean, Oklahoma, when you look at the, even the teachers with their benefit package, it's considered a very generous across the board. I mean, in the state employee situation, in the teacher situation, they have very generous benefit packages in comparison to other states, even though the salaries, don't necessarily square up. So I think a lot of times we're talking apples and oranges. I mean, the governor, yes, he wants to be number one in the region, but getting there, we have to make sure that we're looking at apples and apples. And when you have Texas with talking about spending $6 billion in education, that's our entire state budget in Oklahoma. I mean, people have to really kind of step back and keep this in some perspective. And I think that we'll see kind of how this plays out, but it sounds like more of a big headline than it does some real interesting facts.
Right.
And Neva, I may be wrong. I thought the $6 billion figure was just the amount, an increase in
employment. I think you may be right.
So it wasn't
even
their education budget. It was the amount, an increase here.
We also have four or five times more teachers.
They're a small country down there.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we don't...
It's hard to keep up with the Joneses.
I know. I'm thinking Leukenbach, Texas the entire time here. You know, I think, you know, if we don't fix Real ID, we may have a problem getting into Texas at some point. I think that there are a lot of moving parts here. I think that it's difficult to base your entire success in education funding on a one-to-one comparison from one state to the next. I think right now... Oklahoma would be better off looking at itself and maybe where we were 10 years ago, because even though we've seen some real increases in revenue and appropriations for education, we're going to see that again this year as a result of revenue packages that were passed last year. Still, we're well below where we were 10 years ago if we adjust for inflation. We still have A lot of alternative certification teachers in the classroom were having a hard time recruiting teachers. We're, you know, we haven't even really had a real conversation about support staff, cafeteria workers, janitorial staff. We haven't had a real conversation, or we're beginning to have a conversation at least around school counselors and how important that is to get those plugged in, and so that we don't have just one counselor that's rotating among several different schools, but we have counselors that are in those classrooms or in those schools that know those students, that are helping them with their professional and their emotional development in those schools. You know, those are all real conversations. And frankly, as much as we're grateful for what's happened with the revenue increases and the appropriations, we're well behind. And so Oklahoma teachers, you know, we hear talk about pay raise this year, but really what we're talking about is classroom funding and increasing the amount of money that's going into the formula so that the wraparound services that teachers depend on and support staff depend on to provide services to students, that those are funded as well.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.